Hello and welcome to The Central Question, a podcast that explores the craft of creative nonfiction, hosted by Sean Prentice, that's me, and Jessica Hendry Nelson, that's her. We are the co-authors of Advanced Creative Nonfiction, a writer's guide and anthology from Bloomsbury Publishing. In each episode of The Central Question, we interview an author from the textbook's anthology to examine the craft strategies involved in the making of the essay. Thanks for joining us as we explore the central questions of creative nonfiction.
So today we're talking with Kathy Fish about her essay, Collective Nouns for Humans in the Wild. And we're doing that in conjunction with Chapter 11, which is Soundscapes. And our guest, Kathy Fish, has published 5 collections of short fiction, most recently Wildlife, collected works from 2003 to 2018. Her work has been anthologized in Best Small Fictions, Best American Non-Required Reading, and a forthcoming Norton Reader. She teaches her own intensive online flash fiction workshops, and she could also maybe tell you a little bit more about what she's doing if you want, Kathy. She just was telling us that she does writing workshops abroad. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jess and Sean, for having me.
So the first question we ask everybody is, would you mind telling us a little bit about the essay's origin story? What was the impulse to write it? And what in your mind is the essay's central question?
Great, that's a great question and thanks for asking it. So the situation with this piece was that the editor of a magazine called Jellyfish Review was having their second anniversary or something. And the editor, Christopher James, asked me to contribute a piece for their anniversary issue. And, you know, had a piece all queued up and ready to go. And then the Las Vegas shooting happened. This was October 1st of 2017. And I don't know if you remember much about that, but it was a massive, horrible shooting, one of the worst in our country's history. And I was just, you know, we've had such a problem with this in our country. And I was just so emotionally flattened by that. And I couldn't think of anything else. So I did sit down and I started working with this piece, and it really came together, and it felt to me more important than whatever it was that I had that was going to be published by Jellyfish Review. So I wrote to the editor and I said, could you maybe consider this one instead? And to his credit, he said, yes. You know, it wasn't what they usually published. They usually publish flash fiction. But yeah, so it meant a lot to me. And I'm so grateful still to Christopher James for publishing that story at the last minute, basically.
That's great. So, right. I mean, it does, of course, seem to be in response to those 2017 shootings. And we're talking about soundscapes today and word choice. And, you know, as a flash writer, I'm sure, you know, you know, flash to me seems especially reliant on sound and sound patterns and consonants and assonance and connotation. And
yes.
And so and clearly, you know, you're very attuned to that, and it's demonstrated in this piece. And you know, the politics of this piece in some way are married to and influenced by the sound choices that you make. So mm-hmm. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the way that you thought through the relationship of sound and meaning in this highly charged context.
Oh, I love this question too. Well, the thing is with flash, when you are limited in your word count, we really need to make, like you said, those great, very incisive word choices. And sound is another avenue for flash writers to work their craft and to say a lot in a small space. So this is something when I'm teaching flash fiction is I really emphasize that to borrow from the poetic forms and to really pay attention to sound and word choice. and to make the most of them in ways that, you know, a short story writer needn't do. I think sound is always important, but especially so when you are limited in the number of words you can are at your disposal. For me, writing this piece, I did not want to, I made a conscious choice not to add to the violence in any way. So I consciously avoided going into the imagery of guns, blood, death, all of those things. You know, that's fine for other writers who want to, you know, go at this material. But for me, I made a conscious choice to address what I wanted to address without adding violent imagery. So my word choices, you know, I first wanted to go at what is beautiful about humanity. You asked what the central question was. For me, the central question of this piece is, what does it mean to be human? And how does this kind of mass violence towards, you know, our fellow man, how does that dehumanize us? So I was very conscious of really emphasizing the best of humanity, the kindest of humanity, you know, the ways in which humans are kind to each other and are good to each other and serve each other and do, you know, good things for each other, so that by the time I made that shift, it would hopefully have more impact. So my word choices were aimed at that, sort of bringing in the collective nouns and talking about resplendence and beacon and you know, a dream and transcendence and whatnot before I got to the shift to target. And I wanted the word target, even the word target has a harder sound to it than a lot of the other words. So I wanted that to be very evident.
Well, and Kathy, that's a beautiful answer to that. And thanks so much for sharing that. And the last thing you were talking about with target is something I just wanted to linger on in a second. Jess was talking about some of our soundscape techniques. And one of them is repetition. And you were talking about target. And you repeat target over and over. And you don't do that anywhere else in the essay. We have a jubilance or bewailing of toddlers and enlightenment of librarians and so forth and so on. But then it's at the end, a target of concert goers, a target of moviegoers, a target of dancers, a group of school children is a target. And can you talk about why you relied on repetition there, what power it brings?
I love using repetition in flash fiction, in my writing in general. I think it creates a sort of felt experience in the reader, so that, you know, it almost syncs up with heartbeat, those types of things where you feel, you experience the prose or the poetry on a more visceral level. So that choice for me was to sort of emulate or imitate a little bit a gunshot. So boom, 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 like that. I really wanted that to have that part of the piece to have that sound to it, and for it to hopefully be almost physically felt as the reader is experiencing the piece.
Certainly had that effect. And I want to jump back just a little bit, because what you said a minute ago about eschewing the sort of really violent imagery that might have been organic to an essay about this subject matter, you know, and the choice not to. And, you know, we call that flatlining in the textbook, meaning, you know, simply that the more inherently emotional or charged an image is, the less you want to lean into that in your word choices, that you can do this kind of technique where you pull back and it's almost a matter of fact, reportorial tone. And you naturally, you know, you do this in this essay. And I just wonder if that's a technique you use often and why that feels like an effective choice rather than, you know, for the student writer, why not use language to replicate, you know, the horror or the violence or the sensationalism. Mm-hmm. Why does it feel more effective to flatline?
Oh, I love the whole chapter, and I love that the idea of that. And it's also mentioned, I think, Kim Adonizio in her book, Ordinary Genius, she kind of says the same thing. She has a chapter called White Heat, Necessary Coldness. And it's the same idea. It's, you know, oftentimes when we want to convey something very emotionally charged, you know, as you say, the language can kind of turn towards a sort of purple prose. We want so badly for the reader to understand the impact and the power and the horror or the sadness or whatever the emotion is. We want the reader to get that. But for me, sometimes when you do, and a lot of writers use this technique too, if you come at it a little colder, it serves to heighten rather than dampen, I think, the emotional impact of what you're writing about. And that can be very useful for students and new writers when they're given that freedom. I'm saying, you know, we say to them, you don't need to come at it that way. Try coming at it cold. And I was just teaching a little bit of a seminar that had people using factual information and putting that into their story. And facts always, you know, by their very nature, they sort of have that cold quality to them, that flatline quality to them. So you can intersperse, you know, a story that has a very sad story with facts. I was thinking about, actually gave as an example, Diane Schemperlin's short story, Body Language. And she does the same thing. She's writing about a relationship and interspersed these very cold sounding facts about the human body, the human heart. And it just has the opposite effect. You know, that coldness almost makes it the emotion even more strong for me. So that wasn't intentional. I wanted that voice to have a very flat sound to it, sort of a distance almost. And again, that's a way in. That is, sometimes it's very daunting to write about, oh, something as big as mass shootings in our country. How do you go at that? So I think it is a powerful use of voice. It helps you to attack the material, get into the material, and it's less, maybe a little less traumatic for the writer to take that approach.
Well, and I'm just thinking of, this is, I believe, 16 lines long. It nearly looks as much like a poem as a flash essay. Mm-hmm. But the power of that ending, we have all these beautiful collective nouns that we'll talk about in a second. And then again, that repetition of a target, a target, a target. And we don't get that graphicness, but it is powerful and it is beautiful. And thanks for sharing it with us. And thanks for talking about with us. Thanks for talking about it with us.
Thank you.
And I would love to, we've been kind of accidentally, but wonderfully really diving into the central question and the politics of the idea of this peach, which is great. Now I'm going to ask a more mundane question. From what I can tell, you created a lot of the collective nouns of this piece. I don't think anyone else has ever called librarians enlightenment of librarians. And some of them are just straight up beautiful like that. Some are ones we've heard before, a group of musicians as a band, that makes total sense. Some are beautiful and pragmatic, a raft of social workers. I just love that when you're like, yeah, that's exactly who they are. And then some are wildly creative and beautiful to say, a jubilance or a bewailing for toddlers. And as the father of a five-year-old, both of those sound perfect. And I'm wondering if you could just talk about your naming process for these collective nouns and how you came up with them.
Yeah. No matter what I'm writing ever, I always want to inject just a glimmer of humor. So at the beginning, the in the front there where I say a group of musicians is a band, I found that funny myself to just throw that in with all these other very, you know, creative things. So that was what I was doing with that. But, you know, I don't remember. I know that I remember myself sitting down and just my process for writing is to scribble. So I scribbled and wrote down countless possibilities for all these things. I liked to pick words that had a nice sound, again, with the soundscapes to them. And I think I was just going, you know, for intentional beauty with the words and the imagery. I don't know how I came up with bioluminescence. It's a mouthful, but I liked it. I just wanted everything on the top of that to sort of have that dreamy quality to it and that sort of loveliness. So everything would be so lovely up front. And my experience with some of these, the upfront ones were artists and educators and just how the more enlightened and the more sort of beautiful aspects of humanity, you know, is our art and how we create art and bring art into the world. So, you know, visual artists, musicians, short story writers, etc., poets. And then in the second part, I just wanted to go how humans actually, you know, actively serve and help each other. So I was looking for those, my own experience with, you know, especially special education teachers. One of my sons had some special needs when he was in school. And for me, there was such a feeling of transcendence in that work of making children who struggle understand that they were more than their struggle and that there were ways out of that struggle, or there were ways to, you know, rise above whatever troubles they or difficulties they were experiencing. So I was really sort of looking at, and then of course the protester, the group of peaceful protesters is a dream, is alluding to Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. So I made those choices, and I just think, you know, I've had experience with hospice workers too. And, you know, what they do is beyond anything, you know, that any of us can do. And there's such grace to that work. So it was always, those word choices were always aimed at, you know, collective nouns, the ones that are official, the real collective nouns are so interesting. I encourage students to look those up because they are very creative and interesting and fun. So I tried to write my made up collective nouns in that same spirit.
And one thing I love about your collective nouns is we always talk in creative writing about showing and like a bioluminescence. I can see it.
Yeah.
Or a Flannery. I can see it. Or Raft again. I can see it. Or there's one other a dream, I can see it. Mm-hmm. And these images appear as you give these collective nouns that are supposed to be, mm-hmm. you know, theoretically, you know, something large and all encompassing and not all that specific, but they, you chose such beautiful ones that bring direct images to mind.
Yeah, I was going for that. Not all of them necessarily do that. A few of them are more abstract, but as you said, like raft is a very concrete image. Beacon, I really liked beacon for scientists, like they shed light, and so I was trying to go for sort of a mix of the abstract, more telling in the concrete, showing in a very concrete way. And of course, target is as concrete as it gets, I think.
Yeah,
it also has like the whisper of beaker in it, right? Which I think is just, so that felt, doubly appropriate for scientists for me. And I think others of that, these choices do that too. I want to ask what might sound like maybe an obvious question, but I think part of what we're trying to do is pull back the curtain on the craft choices that we make as writers that to us, I think at a certain point, just feel very intuitive. But, there's intuition, but I think all that intuition is born of experience and having, inhabited a lot of these ways of approaching content with, approaching ideas with language that, just have become part of our bodies, in this way. But it started somewhere. And if we, right. if we push ourselves to examine those choices, there actually is, an origin story. And I guess the origin story I want to ask you here is about just like when you make these choices about sound as you're starting to compose, at what point in the process does that become the most acute, or are you most actively aware of it? Is it in the early drafting phase? How are you making those intuitive choices, or is it more like a revision thing?
Well, now for me, I understand all the things. I understand what assonance is and consonance and alliteration. Rhythm, I understand it. And I think you make a really good point that we tend to say, oh, it's just my intuition. But you're right. We as writers read so much and we learn so much and it gets absorbed to a level that we're not, sometimes not consciously doing that. For me, I try to write from sound. Actually, sometimes I begin with sound. I will hear something, a sound that pleases me, and I will intentionally write into that rhythm. One time I was on the road driving somewhere and the, I knew his name would escape me the second I, Warren Zevon song.
Oh, yes.
It's, Send Lawyers, Guns, and Money. And for some reason, that rhythm of da 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 and Lawyers, Guns, and Money stuck in my head, and I did go home and write something into that, the rhythm of that. I plugged in my own words and my own stories. So sometimes I do start with a sound that I just particularly like, and I especially like sound as a writer. It means something to me. It's important to me. But I think that it really gets fine-tuned in the revision process. I really go back and I really, listen. One of my favorite revision tools, and I'm sure you use it as well, is to read the work out loud. And that's where you hear the little clink, the clunky parts. And that is like in that final revision, that's where I'm really, really trying to nail the sound of the piece.
Just said about writing into the rhythm of something, because that's something I do too. And I don't think I've actually ever talked to students about that. It is one of those things that feels like a maybe an idiosyncratic thing to do, but uh-huh. clearly it's not, right? That
I don't think so. That. I mean, I think for it'd be fun actually for students to maybe listen to be read maybe a nursery rhyme or listen to a lot of our early things when we're children or babies are aimed at sound. And I think that happened organically, but now scientists are saying, you know what, it's good to read to a six-month-old baby or even a newborn baby, because they're hearing that rhythm, and that's as important in our communication as the words themselves. And I remember being read nursery rhymes as a child, and I just loved it. It was very pleasing. I think that's a natural human thing with music and rhythm, that naturally pleases us. And I think it would be fun to do that for students. I was just at, I did an online thing that I was a student in, or, you know, took part in, that somebody else was teaching, and it was aimed at the Fibonacci, I don't know if you know what that is. I'm not a scientist, but that mathematical sequence that is supposed to be like a spiral. And right. So they say that, you know, pretty much anything in the universe can sort of be plugged into this or explained by this mathematical sequence. And so there are writers now who are writing intentionally into this sequence. So the teacher actually gave an example of his own work, but also another writer named Bruce Holland Rogers, who wrote a piece intentionally with that rhythm. And it's meant to be pleasing to the ear or to the mind of a reader, just inherently without even realizing what it is. And it's just one word, and then a sentence with five words, and then a sentence with eight words. It's a very distinct and intentional sequence. I think it'd be fun to do that with students. And I think that it would take away the need or the pressure to create a story, because they're so confined. So you have to make these sentences almost like putting a puzzle together. I think that'd be a fun thing to do with students, to have them write to a distinct sound or rhythm.
It makes so much sense to me. I love, that's a great idea, using the Fibonacci sequence to try to compose. Uh-huh. And I'm sure it does sound, I mean, I'm you know, that intuitively sounds right to me, that it, you know, right, there's some science behind it, but that would be pleasing to listen to. And in that way, it is, you can create a kind of puzzle with language sonically, mm-hmm, that if it's not as concrete as, you know, an actual jigsaw puzzle, there's still a framework there. And that framework consists of those rhythms that we, when we hear them, they feel right to us, they sound right to us. And you can start to compose to that rhythm, like you were saying, you know, right, and it becomes less, I mean, it's part artistry, it's part intuition, but that there is a kind of, I think, a scientific backing to that,
right,
that makes sense, especially since that is how we acquire language. Mm-hmm. I hear that now listening to my niece, who's two, learning to talk, and the way she overemphasizes, you know, some of these rhythms that to us we use, but she hears, uh-huh, them and has to, I think probably because it's just harder to, she's not as fluent yet.
Yeah.
So she overemphasizes some of the things that we do naturally. It's cute.
Yeah, it's cool. I have four children. I've raised four children. They're all grown up now. And, you know, I don't feel like I was there's no perfect mom. I wasn't the mom that would get down and get on the floor and wrestle around or, you know, play games or things like that. But I read to them. And that was my favorite part, and they enjoyed it too. And I think, you know, if you do nothing else, at least read to kids, because they're just so, they're like sponges for language. They need language. And it's just a fun thing to do.
Well, and they also, and this is maybe completely unrelated to chapter 11, but they have a memory of words in different ways than we do. You know, they can't read yet. So the story lives in their mind, where for at least me, the story lives on the page and I close the book and I forget much of it. My daughter knows exactly what is going on every single night.
Yeah.
Well, Kathy, we've loved this discussion about soundscapes, the politics to your word choices in the beginning, and then the more pragmatic ideas about how to write and revise within soundscapes. Is there anything we've missed, anything you'd love to add about soundscapes or anything else related to your essay?
No, not that I can think of. I've really enjoyed talking about this particular aspect of writing because it's one of my favorites too. So it's been quite a pleasure. I'm so grateful for your asking me to take part.
Well, thanks so much for sharing. It's just a stunning essay.
Thank you.
The last question we have for you is a question that we always end with. Mm-hmm. And we wonder if you have a writing prompt that you'd be willing to share with our listeners.
I do. I have tons of writing prompts. And you could direct your students to my Substack newsletter that always includes a craft piece and some writing prompts. And I can give that to, I can email that address to you. But one that's easy and it seems to always result in a piece of writing, very basic. I call it 50 random sentences. And the idea is just to take a piece of paper, it's preferably done with paper and pen, just begin. It may be easier to number 1 through 50. And just write sentence after sentence after sentence. No expectations, goal in mind other than to create 50 sentences. If you get stuck at some point, if you're on number 28 and you're like, I can't think of another sentence, just do, I hate this exercise, or I like the color blue, or just write whatever. But something invariably happens. I've had a lot of people tell me that this works for them. I think the human brain just wants to create a narrative. And so in the act of that, you may find you get to the end of your 50, then you may start to write an actual story in the process, or you may not. If you end up and you get to 50, go back and look at which sentences sort of feel like they have some juice to them. They feel like there's something more that could be said, and circle those and put that sentence at the top of a piece of paper and just free write for, 15 minutes or so. It seems to always work. I don't know why, but very basic. Yeah, just write 50 sentences and see where it takes you.
And to get that prompt and a variety of others from Kathy, you can go to artofflashfiction.substack.com or just type Substack Kathy Fish into your search engine. It'll take you right there.
Oh, thanks for that, Sean.
You're welcome. Kathy, thanks so much for talking with us today about your essay, soundscapes, and writing in general. We really love the conversation.
Yeah, I had a great time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us as we explore the central questions of creative nonfiction. Please rate and review The Central Question. Feel free to follow Sean and Jess at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Have a great day and keep essaying.